Good morning. We will call the Property and Local Tax Division to order for February 2nd, 2011. And we're going to continue with our presentation on property tax aids and credits with Mr. Steve Hines from House Research. And let's see, we'll have a motion for approval of the minutes from January 26th. Representative Markwart approves the minutes of January 26th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes approved. Great, thank you. I believe then if you're ready, Mr. Hines, we're going to hear about county program aid.
Madam Chair, thank you. We will be kind of picking up in the orientation from last week. I believe that was just last Wednesday we were in this. And we'll be, so on your slides, hopefully these are still in your folders, we'll be in the packet that's where the lead slide is a history of tax aid and credit programs, and we'll be on, I think, starting on slide 21 in that document. And then I would also be referring a little bit to this longer overview of property taxes document, if that's still around, that looks like this. That was probably handed out a couple weeks ago now. Okay. But I'll make a few slight references to that hopefully you can still find. We can produce more copies okay. If you don't have those. But
there may be some extras on the cart if anyone is looking for some. I have one called Overview of Property Taxes. The slides, is that not what we're...
Madam Chair, that is an older version, but I think that the slides for the county program aid are the same in that one, so we can probably find them in there, too.
Okay.
That was in the first... Right. Anyway, the first set of slides we prepared for the first meeting, and we moved some of them into the second presentation.
So okay, well, Mr. Hines,
if anyone's lost, they can raise their hands and we can try to straighten them out. But so county program aid, which we talked about kind of just in aggregate before, now we're going to go into a little more detail on how that program or how that formula works. County program aid was created in the 2003 session with calendar year 2004 as its first year, and even in that first year it was really just the sum of the aid under the programs of HACA, Homestead and Agricultural Credit Aid, Attached Machinery Aid, County Criminal Justice Aid, and Family Preservation Aid. So those four programs, of those four, HACA was by far the largest of those. The others are much smaller, but we're still taking into account in designing the formula that it lies behind the county program aid, that lies behind the current county program aid formula. That formula has been the same ever since it was first instituted in 2005. The county program aid is really, it's about a $200 million program, give or take, and it is really, there's two formulas that constitute county program aid, and there's about half the money that goes out under each program. One is called the need-based aid, and the other is called tax-based equalization aid. And just a point that also was, as we saw in the previous testimony and in the LGA testimony, in 2008, 2009, and 2010, this program has been reduced from the counties have received less than they were certified to receive due to state budgetary conditions. The need-based aid uses three factors in it: the county and county age index, which is really a population index, I might say. It's population weighted by more heavily towards people over.
Excuse me, is there some people are looking for materials or what?
We were just making sure that Madam Chair that everyone has.
Okay, it's just a little bit distracting, so. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Hines. Please proceed.
Sure. And I should point out, too, that there's a little more detail on how the formula actually works on page 25 of this longer document that's not PowerPoint slides. So if you have this one called Overview of Property Taxes, page 25 has a more detailed explanation of the formulas in county program aid. But I'm going to run through them kind of quickly here anyway. So the need-based aid is based 40% on this county population, age-weighted population index, 20% on a crime, on the number of crimes in the county, and 40% based on the number of households receiving food stamps. And that, as I said, this formula has been in place ever since the program was first created. And then the second half of the county program aid formula, tax-based equalization aid, uses only two factors, the population of the county and the size of the county's tax base. And I might point out, and it's come up a couple times, that I've gotten a couple members' questions even this year, that the tax-based equalization aid formula is somewhat volatile. I would say that a fairly small change in tax base can cause a fairly large amount of swing in aid, and that's been particularly the case recently for the very rural counties, especially in the western part of the state, that have had increasing ag values, have seen this tax-based equalization aid component drop off precipitously in the last year or two. So that might be an issue for redesigning this program at some point. The next slide shows, just sort of make this point, that the need-based aid, which uses these three indexes, the age-adjusted population, households on food stamps, and crimes, the distribution, just the very crude measure, just the distribution metro, non-metro, almost exactly the same percentage distribution in 2011 as it was in 2006. But the next slide, the tax-based equalization aid, you can see that in 2006, that goes about 69% non-metro, 30% metro, and then in 2011, the metro piece has increased somewhat substantially, and that is a function of this volatility on this tax-based equalization aid that I just talked about, where the agricultural parts of the state have been growing in value. And especially in the last 3 years, almost every other type of property in the state has been losing value. So relatively speaking, the agricultural dominant counties have really grown quite significantly in value, and that's caused this shifting from the non-metro counties to the metro counties. I guess another point to make is that the tax-based equalization aid is the more important part of the program for non-metro counties, whereas the need formula is almost exactly splits the way the population splits between metro and non-metro. And I think with then the next slides, these now, just to keep you off balance a little bit more, these four slides are probably show up in your packet as right before the county program aid slides. We just changed the order at the last minute. And just to show the trend lines in how some of these property tax relief program spending has gone. So in real money, this first slide just shows the total spending on on property tax relief programs in inflation-adjusted dollars. So these are 2009 dollars, and you can see that it's sort of been relatively constant over, I don't know, I guess, you know, it was at its height in the early 80s, and then declined somewhat to 1995. And this is a little misleading as to what years things happen, because these are just five-year snapshots. So it might look like a trend happened in 1995 that might actually be a little bit before or after, but we're only looking at the every five-year numbers here. You can see that the numbers did drop off then considerably from 2000 to 2005, and that's largely that's somewhat misleading. In 2001 reform, which we've talked about, is being a very significant feature of Minnesota's, or a very significant time frame in Minnesota's property tax relief history. The state took over the general education levy, so a lot of what used to be sort of property tax relief sort of now starts showing up as education spending and no longer as a property tax relief program per se, but that's a little misleading to look at that big drop-off there.
Mr. Hines, are we looking at the total program cost then? Is that $2 billion in property tax relief programs?
Madam Chair, that's correct. That's okay. A little under $2 billion in 2000 and, well, I shouldn't say a little under, but it's between $1.5 billion and $2 billion in the current year.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And then the next slide shows the same figures, but now it's showing it rather than in the gross dollars as a percentage of the general fund. So it's possible, it's, I guess, interesting to see how high those numbers were back in the 80s when we were up at 23% of the general fund. 23 looks like maybe the peak in the early 80s. And then how much that has declined since then to where we're now in less than 10% of the general fund in those property tax relief programs. Again, somewhat that last drop from about 13% to 8%, a lot of that is the fact that the general education became a state expenditure and replaced really in some ways some of the property tax relief programs that had been in place. The next slide then shows kind of the distribution of the property tax relief programs by category of property tax relief programs. So on the top you see the direct payments to taxpayers, and that's the property tax refund, renter, homeowner and renter. Then the blue is the credit programs, which now that's the market value credit and the homestead and the agricultural market value credit programs. Back in the 80s and late 70s, there was a different homestead credit program. And then the dark blue is the aid programs. Probably the most significant feature to note there is that reform in 1988-89, we eliminated the homestead credit program and converted it all into an aid program. And so for a little over a decade there, we didn't have any real credit programs of significance. Then in 2000, it came back in the late 90s. In 2001, we created the market value credit and got rid of this HACA program. I guess another thing to point out is maybe just how significantly bigger the yellow bar has gotten toward the in the last two bars there, the 2005 and 2011. That's been a conscious effort of the legislature to use more of the property tax relief spending in the property tax refund programs, the income-related programs. And this fourth slide in this little series then also cuts it one more way, which is looking at what types of jurisdictions or which jurisdictions get the money. And again, the cities have always been the largest recipient of the between cities, counties, and school districts. They've been the largest over the years. And the county share, I think, has been relatively constant. The school district share is where it really varies quite a bit, and that's, again, somewhat misleading because at some point the credit programs were going to schools, then for a while they weren't, but meanwhile all this aid on the school spending side went into schools, and that's somewhat responsible for why the bars get so low at some point. And right now, schools get very little of the credit programs. They're primarily back to the cities and counties. And again, the yellow bar, the direct taxpayer money, has gotten larger in this decade, especially. So that concludes the aid and credit presentation we're going to do. And the next thing we were going to do is Ms. Schill is going to go through things like revenue analyses.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Hines. And welcome, Ms. Schill. And
good morning, Madam Chair and members.
Give your name and department for the record.
My name is Catherine Schill. I'm the fiscal analyst for the Property Tax Division. Right now, I'm handing out slides for the PowerPoint, and that basically is just a summary of some of these tools that we will go over this morning.
Sure.
And most for members that have been on this committee before, these tools are going to look very, very familiar. We have, this is just a quick overview, we have the tax and aids and credits spreadsheet, and I'll go over that and how it relates to the catalog of budget activities and November and February forecasts. We have revenue estimates, fiscal notes, local impact notes, and a brief series of other items. The property tax aids and credits spreadsheet, this is a significant overview. We have 32 budget items on our spreadsheet. The spreadsheet looks like this. And the spreadsheet itself is divided into five major categories, including the following: property tax refunds, local government aids, property tax credits, local pension aids, and then other appropriations. And in a big overview, and this is a kind of a repeat of a slide that Mr. Hines presented, but what I am doing here in this particular slide is showing you for the next biennium. We're covering fiscals 12 and 13. Our base budget right now, according to the November forecast, is $3.52 billion. And you can see how this is spread out amongst those other categories, the five categories that I told you about. Major property tax aids represent 47.3% of our budget here. Property tax refunds, 30.2%. Tax credits, meaning mostly market value credit and agricultural homestead credits, 16.1%, and all other, that little category, the lavender one on the top, is 6.3%. So you can see where the bulk of the money is spent. This is a listing of those 32 items that I mentioned, and that this slide and the previous slide are contained in the catalog of budget of activities. And how this relates to the spreadsheet, every item that you have on your spreadsheet has a description, has a brief history, and the November forecast information going forward, including the planning estimates for fiscal 14 and 15. And what that looks like, okay, this is your spreadsheet, and I've simplified it as I can, showing the November forecast information. But I want to get to the example in the catalog of budget activities. This is a sample entry. This one happens to be for the local impact note cost. But what you can see is the snapshot that I was talking about. You have the title of the budget activity item. You have a citation, the statute where it is founded, or if it's not in the statute, it's in Minnesota laws, that citation is also provided for you, depending on the item, of course. The type of appropriation is important. You have an explanation also of the different types of appropriations in your catalog. I believe it's page four and five, where it distinguishes what's a statutory appropriation, what is a direct appropriation, what's an open appropriation, and a standing appropriation. And it's important to know in this committee, most of the items that you see, in fact, all of them on the spreadsheet, are established in statutory language as opposed to being Minnesota laws. I think we only have two items on the overall 32 that are established in Minnesota laws. And they are either standing or open appropriations. That's important to know, that because they are ongoing, very different from other spending committees where most of the items are direct appropriations. And most of our items are in the general fund, as opposed to a series of other special funds. And in fact, we only have one that is a special revenue item, that is the contamination tax. And then finally, you have a brief description, meaning that you can do a snapshot of understanding for this item here. And what's important, at least in my mind, I get questions on different parts of the spreadsheet. We've had some great coverage of the history of a number of items that you see on the spreadsheet by House Research. The questions that I get a lot are the ones that show up on the spreadsheet that we don't have much preview on, and those are the pension items or some of the other items that kind of are one-time spending or last for a short period and then disappear off of the spreadsheet. Moving to our revenues, this is the second item that will help you evaluate what is going through the committee in bill form, and we'll talk about revenue estimates. And that's what this page is going to go over. A revenue estimate. Yes.
Okay, I'm lost a little bit. So which page are you holding up?
Okay, we're moving away from the catalog of budget activities, which is the one you have in your hand, I think, to this revenue estimate summary. It's a separate document.
Okay. All right, thanks much.
Okay. A revenue estimate provides an analysis of the direct impact on state tax revenues that would result from a proposed change in state tax law. They are prepared by the Department of Revenue tax research staff. Minnesota statute section 270C.11 subdivision 5 requires that given reasonable notice, the commissioner prepare an estimate of the effect of state tax revenues, which would result from the passage of a legislative bill establishing, extending, or restricting a tax expenditure. Unlike a fiscal note, and I'll get to that in a minute, a revenue estimate does not estimate the administrative cost to a state agency or local government. A revenue estimate provides a summary of a proposed change in law as it relates to current law. It explains the methodology used and the latest forecast information and other data as appropriate. And similar to fiscal notes, revenue estimates are static analyses. They sometimes include behavioral responses, commonly with changes to alcohol and cigarette tax changes, obviously for the overall tax committee, not in this division, and generally assume 100% tax compliance. To request an estimate for a bill or an amendment, and we do revenue estimates for amendments as well, you need to contact fiscal staff. That would be either me or Ms. Templin in the fiscal analysis office. And this is what a revenue estimate looks like. Actually, this is one from last year, Representative Scott's bill. But basically, you can see on this, it's done by Department of Revenue. You can see the upper right-hand corner. They try to indicate to us their interpretation of whether there would be administrative costs and savings, and when it's a yes, that means look for a fiscal note to also accompany this kind of revenue, this kind of change for the bill being considered. You'll see the fund impact. Obviously, this has fiscal 10 through 13. Most of what you will see for the committee now will be fiscal 12 through 14. And then you have an idea of which fund and an explanation of the bill. You can normally get a revenue analysis if you either ask us or if your bill is actually placed on the agenda for one of the tax committees, either the division or the tax committee, and it will automatically occur, so you don't have to put forth a special request. If you want information before the committee, then you'll just need to let us know that you're interested in seeing that before the bill presentation. Those are revenue estimates. And at times, we have updates to revenue estimates as a bill travels through the process. So you can actually have actions taken in the division, and then as it moves to taxes and then other places along the way, ways and means, you'll have updates to revenue estimates. And especially for property tax proposals, this is something new. This is something that went into effect last year, and I don't think you have this in your packet. I added this slide. Minnesota Statutes 270C.991 last year was passed that sought to have more information available on changes in property tax law and its impact on the overall property tax system. And these are a series of benchmarks and evaluations that are required to be on a property tax revenue estimate. And this is something that Department of Revenue, the tax research section, will be providing for you. And this is what it looks like. Actually, I pulled this right from House File 130, because that was the first one that we had that actually had an impact in this form. We didn't have any of these last year. And so you can see how that particular bill is would impact the property tax system in particular.
Michelle, I just wonder if it's very hard to read. I think we'd all appreciate maybe a bigger printout of it. Maybe staff could get that at some point for committee members.
Right. Madam Chair, you can see the one, I think six or seven, the measures for the property tax principles: transparency, understandability, simplicity, and accountability is one section. Efficiency and compliance is the second. Equity, both vertical and horizontal equity, stability and predictability, competitiveness for business, and then the last category is responsiveness to economic conditions. And the impact, as it goes through, we're finding it gets more complicated when the bills are more omnibus in nature. When you have several different changes going on in a single bill, you will see a lot. This will become more specific with where some of the impacts actually are. So yes, we can get that further information.
So Michelle, this is new as of last year.
Correct.
And it's, how do you see it being beneficial in the whole process? I mean, to everyone who's involved.
Madam Chair and members, Minnesota's property tax system is very complicated, and some say it is the most complicated of all the 50 states. We, in Minnesota, have a number of changes to the property tax law, and as of late, I would say that those changes have caused a lot of confusion. And so as the committee and the legislature considers changes in the property tax law, this particular measure scale is meant to highlight how some of those changes would impact the current system we have. There is a whole separate presentation by the Department of Revenue on the property tax system and what its current state is right now, and that might be something that would be of interest to these members to see that presentation.
So, Michelle, we're in effect kind of guinea pigging it this year and seeing how maybe it will be useful in guiding decisions. And
that's exactly right, Madam Chair.
We're learning here.
Yes, this is meant to highlight as you have, as a bill changes the property tax system, what its impact on the overall system is, separate and apart from the financial impact. Mm-hmm. And we see the financial impact estimated with revenue estimates, but the overall system, as each change in law occurs, is gaining more complexity. And so that's part of what is being evaluated here.
I think we have a question. Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could just try to understand what decrease means. I mean, I know in general what the word means, but I'm not sure how it applies in this situation. I'm wondering if you could go over that. Maybe looking at the competitiveness for business, the one aid cut says decrease, but then it says business property taxes likely increase, which would theoretically, I would think that would be an increase. But I'm not sure which side of the fence we're referring to.
Madam Chair and Representative Barrett, there is a whole separate presentation on the property tax principles. And as each bill comes through, I mean, we need to take more time than what we have today to amply address the question. And so, Madam Chair, I could perhaps, someone from the Department of Revenue.
Get more in depth at a later
date. I think that would be more appropriate because the effect is applied to each element contained within a bill, and this one in particular will need some time to review.
All right, Ms. Phil, thank you.
Members, moving on to the next tool, and this is something more common, especially as you've seen in other spending committees, fiscal notes. Fiscal notes, a fiscal note is an estimate of the administrative costs or revenue impacts that are attributable to a proposed change in law. Minnesota statute section 3.98 requires the content of a fiscal note to include the statutory provisions affected, express the effect in dollar amounts, estimate the increase or decrease in revenues, include the costs that may be absorbed by an agency or program without additional funds, include assumptions in determining cost estimates, and specify long-range implications. A fiscal note may comment on the technical or mechanical defects in the bill, but shall not express opinions concerning the merits of the proposal. And fiscal notes are done, they're managed by the Minnesota Management and Budget. Once they receive a legislative request for a fiscal note, the bill is reviewed and assigned to the appropriate state agency or agencies. And what's important to know is that fiscal notes take about 5 to 7 business days to process. And so sometimes the process lags for when we need it here in committee, and we try to get fiscal notes as quickly as possible so you have both tools to work with in your decision making. And the last item here are local impact notes. Local impact notes estimate the local government or school district fiscal impact of a proposed change in law. Minnesota statute section 3.987 governs the procedure and coordination of the local impact note process. It also mentions instances when the note is not going to be prepared. And there's a whole listing of these. I think you have it in your materials. This process is also governed by the Office of Minnesota Budget and Management, with impact from local officials. And you should know that a local note can actually take several weeks to produce because the way it's managed, the requests go out to local officials, they gather the information and bring it back to the commissioner. And local impact notes can only be requested by leadership in the tax committee, this committee, and Ways and Means. Other tools to know about, and I think it's in your packet closer to the end. There's you've got a copy of the price of government. We actually had that last week. I referred to it in committee deliberations. I printed out the November forecast version of the price of government for your information, and it's contained in your materials. There's also a Department of Revenue handbook, which is very handy. It is available online. We did not copy it for the committee, but we can. It looks something like this, but it gives a history of all the taxes and amounts that have been spent. At the very end, starting with page 47, they have a section on local taxes. That will help give a better idea of some of the revenue streams, and it actually has a summary of the local sales tax.
Yes, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, I missed. What was the title of that online?
It's called the Minnesota Tax Handbook. We can get this copied for members if you would like. It is also a publication of the Department of Revenue.
How about if you just send me the link?
Well, I'll send you the link.
Members, we will actually have Bobby put that online and everybody can get
right.
a copy.
When the hard copy version comes out, it's a smaller document like this, a size like this. And it's extremely handy, especially when you're looking at, it's got everything from mining production taxes to aggregate material, local sales tax collections, local franchise tax, all of the items. Yes, Ms. Dalton has one right now. So if you're interested in what the 32 cities that have local sales taxes, they're all listed here, when they started. It's a very handy booklet to have for reference. The Department of Revenue is moving down the list to the tax incidence study. That's another document that we refer to on occasion. And then there are various other studies through the National Conference of State Legislature, the Council of State Government, actually NASBO, National Association of State Budget Offices. We bring these other kinds of studies and places for information on an as-needed kind of basis. Lastly, I will give an endorsement to Mr. Ouellette. I don't know if he's in the audience, but there's a great presentation done by the Department of Revenue, the Property Tax System Overview, and it kind of gives you the overall flavor of what's going on in Minnesota. They also reference the various different tools that I've mentioned here, and the presentation would be, I think, very worthwhile for this committee to hear. That's me. And I have just the last two slides in your materials are kind of a repeat of some of the things that Mr. Hines presented, but this will give you the November forecast extension of those materials, and this is the 15 years of biennial spending as it goes out to fiscal year 15. And that's it.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Schill. Any questions? And if not, we will be moving on. So thank you to, did you have something, Mr. Hines?
Well, Madam Chair, the next thing that we were going to go through, and you okay. may want to have us defer this part, was Ms. Dalton and I were going to spend a little time just going over how to read the printouts for the LGA printouts and the property tax simulation printouts. We could do that later or do that right now.
I'm thinking we have some time. We wanted to get to our next presenter by about 9:10.
Okay. Ms. Dalton will go first.
So, as becoming evident, there are many, many pieces and parts to this system. And we're all going to get familiar with it. Yes, Representative McDonald.
Madam Chairman, since we were waiting, and because of your comment, I'm going to echo that. I do appreciate the piece of paper that says the transparency, understandability, simplicity, and accountability. And is this system clear for taxpayers and clear for public officials? So just a backbone on your comment. Appreciate all the material that was presented to us.
Thank you. All right, Ms. Dalton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Pat Dalton with House Research. And the other thing that probably has become very clear is this committee runs on paper. last week, everybody had a copy of a city aid handout, and this is actually the aids and credits, what is happening under House File 130. And I don't know if you all still have it.
I think we're going to get a copy
okay,
for everyone.
I actually think then that maybe we will start with something I do hope you all have, and that is this computer simulation policy that is in House Research, and I think Mr. Hines will actually talk about that first.
right. We're also getting a copy of that for the members.
Well, I think we can talk about it even without you having a copy in front of you. We have slightly different confidentiality rules as it relates to property tax modeling. We want everyone to be to know what those are so nobody is surprised. House Research does a number of modeling. We model the aid programs, the county and city aid programs. We model aid, we have a school finance system model. We model income, we have a income tax model that models tax burdens by income class and filing status. And then we also have our large property tax model where we model tax burden by property type and geographic area.
The things that are a little bit tricky sometimes get into the timing of when these kinds of models that we have, when their results are sort of become public. So a couple of points we wanted to make is, as far as lead time goes, it's difficult to sort of say this is how many days we need, because a proposal can be very complicated to model or very easy to model. Obviously, the more time we have, the more chance there is that we can do it in the timing you're hoping for. But just be aware that it isn't necessarily the push of a button when you want a new AIDS LGA formula modeled or some change to the property tax system that you want to see what the results would be. The confidentiality of a proposal under development. While you are working with us on a proposal, and this is goes for any of the sort of analytic tools in house research, but primarily we're thinking about the LGA, a CPA run, or a property tax run, as we call them. While you're working with us, everything is confidential. You are working with us, and you're the only one who sees the results of what we're doing, unless you choose to make it available to other people. That's your choice. However, once a proposal becomes public, then it's no longer sort of owned by the person who's thinking of the proposal. It's all of a sudden anyone could ask us to sort of model the results of the proposal that's out there. So, so of course, when a bill is introduced, anyone has the right to ask us to model it. But sometimes in the past, we've had to even go so far as to say, even if it becomes public through a press conference, so if a member has a press conference and said, this is my proposal, at that point, if we consider it to be public, and if we run the model, or we will run it at that point and distribute it to anyone who asks for it. So just be aware of that it's sort of up to the member working with us to decide when it goes from the private sort of sphere to the public sphere by doing something public with it. So again, sometimes there's been issues in past years where it's been a little touchy on some of these subjects. That being said, when we do run a simulation, we will first give the results to the author of the proposal, even if the author didn't request it. So if Representative X asks us to work on a proposal or puts forth a proposal, and Representative Y asks us to see a simulation of it, we will give those results to the author of the proposal first, even though they didn't specifically ask for them. And to give the author a little time to prepare to respond to what the results might show. And typically, the person developing the proposal knows what has been working with us and knows the results. But just in case it comes up that they haven't been, they get the first chance. Then within the ideal time frame for us is that within about 24 hours, we would give it to the person who asked for the analysis rather than the author. And then shortly after that, we would disseminate it broadly through the webs, copying to people or just posting it on the House Research website. There's an exception to some of these time frames. The delay period can be shortened or even eliminated if the proposal is being heard in a House committee or on the floor. So if it's that close to having a hearing, obviously then we need to get the information to the committee in time for them to deliberate on the proposal. Others may request simulations that are variations of the basic proposal, or may request additional analysis of a proposal, and the author would not automatically get a copy of these simulations. So if you wanted to do something similar to what Representative X was doing, that becomes your private proposal again, and the author doesn't have any ownership of that idea once you're sort of developing something that's a little different from the proposal that's being discussed. Another issue that sometimes can be a little bit tricky is, and this is more with regard to property tax modeling than LGA, is what level of detail is the output presented at. For LGA, the only really level that makes sense is to show each individual city's results, and that's what will be done. When it comes to the property tax model, generally on those we would prefer to present results at the regional level, which we'll show you in a minute what that regional level is if you're not already familiar with it. Partly because the city level results is so much dependent on the assumptions that are built in on, particularly on levy assumptions, that we would just as soon not look at individual cities where we really don't know what the cities are going to be levying, what individual jurisdictions are. So we will, if I think I'll just leave it at that primarily we prefer to do the property tax runs at the regional level. I think I'll just leave it at that.
I was just saying,
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think one of the things that's important to understand is by the middle of March, we will have projections for what will be happening in pay 2012. Right now, all you're seeing is current law for the current year, but we should have data, and we should be. We work with the Senate and the Department of Revenue in developing model assumptions to model 1 year out. And we're in the process of starting that procedure, but by the end of March, we will be having a baseline 2012 property tax model. We will be telling you what aids and credits under current law will be in 2012. And then from there on out, we will be modeling as proposals go forward. We will be modeling changes from that baseline 2012 and comparing new proposals to that. We don't have those ready yet. We're just getting the final data. And then we have to start looking at how well we have projected in the past, what changes we have to make in our projection methodology. Our methodology is really based on trying to be as accurate as possible at a state, metro, non-metro level, but the lower the level of geographic area that we look at, the more inaccurate our modeling is. That's just a function of, we don't know what 855 cities are actually going to levy next year. We don't know what 87 counties and 1,815 townships are going to do, and we have to make a guess. And our guesses may be, hopefully, are reasonable at the statewide level, but at an individual jurisdiction level, we'll tell you we're wrong. I believe we've now handed out runs. So if everyone has this run, this is a city run, and if you just open it up to the first page, you will see that it starts with cities in the metro area. There's five pages of cities in the metro area, and then it's followed by about 15 pages of cities in greater Minnesota. This is our standard way that
everyone
we present cities.
And you will everyone finding where we're at?
Okay. And you will notice the cities are not in geographic order. If you, they aren't by count. We've been using for about since I started here, so since 1987 to look at cities, and what it allows you to do is allows you to compare similar cities because they're grouped together and say, well, what's happening to my city compared to similar cities? It also allows you to see it's hard to figure out what a proposal does to types of cities when you're looking at 855 cities alphabetically or even geographically. This allows you to say, well, this program helps smaller cities, or this program seems to not give money to older suburbs. And so it's a way of kind of looking at it in a different grouping that allows you to get your head around what some of the proposals are actually doing. We tried to do comparisons between current law and the alternatives. As you notice, there are six columns of numbers. That's about the most columns I can get on a printout. These columns change depending on what it seems to be important on that proposal. For the House File 130 proposal, the bill was trying to say that everyone will get the lesser of what they got paid in 2010 or what they were certified to get paid in 2011. So on this printout, you notice that the first two columns are what they were paid in 2010 in LGA or what they were certified to get under current law in 2011. And then it shows you what they're actually going to get under House File 130 in the first engrossment. And this one shows both the LGA and the estimated market value credits on a city-by-city basis.
Mr. Hines.
Madam Chair, now if I could turn your attention to this, the last packet that we are going to be talking about, which is this one that was just handed out, again, I think, that starts with the computer simulation policy on the front. And that I've already talked about a little bit. Some of those concepts might be a little easier once I've walked through what the printouts look like. Ms. Dalton gave a good background for when these property tax simulations come into play. Typically, we're trying to get up to speed to put out a estimated 2012 property taxes under current law. In mid-March, that's probably a good estimate of when we might be able to get that done. And at that point, we would start to look at proposals compared to that baseline 2012. For now, we're kind of in, I call it kind of in a limbo state. We can't really model 2012. If somebody wants us to look at something, we can do it as if it were in effect for 2011, and that kind of maybe has to suffice for the time being. But just kind of this presentation is designed to just look at the mechanics of how to read these things once all of a sudden somebody's showing you one. And so I've tried to circle the important pieces I want to look at on the first page. This is the first page would always look like this. The upper left-hand corner, there's a number for the simulation. That's sometimes useful just to compare it to see if it's if you're holding two of them to see if they're the same. Look to see if it's the same number. This one that I hand out is 9E1, it's called, and the date. The date is also a good tip-off as to whether it's the same printout or not. These can tend to look alike when you see a lot of them. The next thing down is it defines, the printout uses the terms baseline and alternative all the time, and it defines what the terms mean. In this printout, it's always comparing two different property tax regimes, and in this case, the baseline is actual payable taxes in 2009, and the alternative is projected 2010 under current law. So it's useful to always know what, frequently you need to go back to figure out what is it trying to compare, and usually it is either the 1 year versus the next, or it's the same year but under the current law versus under proposal would be the two most common things. Then this first page in the little box tries to give a real brief overview of what the simulation is all about, and a couple of the key results of the simulation are listed on below on the first page. The second page, which is the small Roman numerals, contains a little detail on the assumptions for the baseline and the alternative, and I won't walk through those now, but those should always be there and hopefully can help answer questions that might come up as to what, how whatever's being proposed is being modeled. Roman numeral page 4 is the simulation parameters, which is the class rates, that frequently a property tax proposal involves a change in the class rate structure, and that would be captured on this page as well. That's not always the case, that there's a change in class rates, but frequently that's what we're really modeling it for. The next two pages are then the maps of the regions that we use for the property tax model results. And so first page, Roman numeral 5, is Greater Minnesota. And there we've got, well, you can see the regions there. They entail anything from 4 or 5 counties to, you know, 10 or 12, depending on how sparsely populated maybe the regions are and sort of similar characteristics is hopefully involved in this. We've been using these regions for a long time, so they've at least got that going for them. And then usually these regions on the printouts will actually be two pages for each region. One will be the cities within that geographic area, and one will be the townships within that geographic area. Notice that the Taconite area is its own kind of region, and Olmsted County is a separate region just because it's so large, broken out from the rest of the southeast Minnesota. And then the next page, Roman numeral 6, is the breakout of the regions in the metropolitan area. And largely those follow county lines. We see within Hennepin County we've actually got 4 regions, including the city of Minneapolis as its own region. And then in Ramsey County, St. Paul is its own region, and then the rest of the county is considered a region. The next page then is the actual first page of data in the printout. Then, and the first page, always look to the upper right corner when you see that all this sort of heavy detail printout is the geographic area that's being described on this page. So in this case, this page 1 is the statewide results of the model run. The baseline and alternative are noted at the top of the page as to what we're talking about, what we're comparing, because then the runs themselves or the data tables just use the terms baseline and alternative. So you need to refer back to the top of the page to see what is the baseline and what is the alternative here. In the top half of the page is a table of different types of property that are listed over on the left-hand side. Then there's a series of columns that relate to how the market value is between the two, the baseline and the alternative for that class of property. So, for instance, the first line in this line between pay 09 and pay 10, and this is our projected pay 10 under current law, homesteads were actually decreasing in value by our estimate then was by 3% on existing homes on the market value side. But then the second set of columns over on the right relates to the change in tax burden. And in this case, we show in that top line, which I should have circled but didn't, that the homesteads were showing on an aggregate statewide were going up in tax by 4.7%. That's under percentage change column, kind of the third from the right, the one I've circled. That's by far the most, the column you're most likely to want to look at when you're looking at a property tax run is that third from the right column that says percentage change. That's usually what people want to know. What is it? How are tax burdens changing under this proposal or under the simulation? And in this case, residential homes would be increasing 4%, 4.7 on average statewide. The bottom of that table is the total for all types of property. Again, that's a very important number. In this case, this is showing that the total change in property tax burden we were predicting between pay 9 and pay 10 would be 6.1% for all types of property. And sometimes these classes of property can change a little bit, so it's good to always look to make sure they're the same. I mostly use the same set each time, but depending on what a proposal is doing, if it's sort of splitting a class of property into two new classes, we might separate that one out in that column to make it to identify what's going on with the class that's really being looked at specifically.
Mr. Hines, just in the interest of time, is there quite a bit more to your presentation?
No, I'll just do it
Okay.
Two-second version. All the pages on the printout are the same. The statewide page does not have the part that all the others have at the bottom, which is tax burdens on hypothetical properties. So in those cases, we've got homes, apartments of a certain market value, and you can see what's happening with those. But then the rest of the printout is just each page is a different geographic area, which, again, look to the upper right for what geographic area is being discussed. And I can leave it at that. And I'll obviously take questions later.
Very good. There you go. Excellent. Well, thank you very much to House Research. Fantastic review, and we're all learning a lot as we go. But was there a question over here?
Yeah, just a question for you. Thank you, Madam Chairman. Question on the percentage of change on the right-hand column that you had circled, and we see an increase as opposed to the percentage of change on the left side. Is that because the cities then at that point certified their levies, and based upon their levies they increased them or decreased them? In this case, it appears that most cities have perhaps increased their levies, and does that column just indicate that? And that's all my question is. Thank you so much.
Mr. Hines?
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, where do I begin? The simulation is trying to show the results of all the different things that are going on in the property tax system. But I think your basic point is that cities, counties, school districts, et cetera, choose to do with their levies is what is a heavy determinant of what ends up in that last column in that tax change. And it's more related to that, perhaps, than it is to what's going on the left side. Even if values are going down, taxes can still be going up. And typically, taxes do go up from year to year by some amount. For now.
Representative McDonald?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. I mean, I just wanted to, for perhaps my sake, but more so all of us, just that's the indication. Oftentimes, you'll hear taxpayers or citizens say, my house values went down, but yet my property tax went up. And in this example, statewide, that seems to be prevalent in all cities throughout the whole state.
On average, this was showing that would be the case, pretty typical case, that would be homes going down and home values going down and taxes going up. Yes.
All right. Ms. Shield, did you have one comment on that?
I do, members. In response to Representative McDonald and others' questions, I provided a full-size version of the property tax principles and the questions associated with that and how the analysis is done. And so you at least have a one-pager. It's full size, and hopefully that will help you understand what's going on there.
Great. Well, thank you. We're going to move on then. Our second presenter today is from Minnesota Taxpayers Association, Mr. Mark Haveman. And I think that the key difference is that House Research gives us information that is supposed to be neutral in terms of a position, and I know they try very hard to be neutral, and we appreciate that. But there are reasons to take a point of view on this system and so on and so forth. So the Taxpayers Association, I think, has done a wonderful job of really shedding more light on how it's working and who it's benefiting and so on. And maybe you can begin, Mr. Haveman, and thanks very much for coming today.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Mark Haveman. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Taxpayers Association. For those of you who don't know too much about us, we're an 85-year-old organization dedicated to research and education in support of accountable, efficient government and good tax policy. We have had a long interest in the issue of intergovernmental finance, the relationship between property taxes and local aids. We've watched the evolution of the Minnesota Miracle with tremendous interest and done a number of research studies on property taxes and aid-related issues. And as a result, it's very much appreciated to have the opportunity to talk a little bit about some of the issues that we see and offer some reform ideas for you to consider in these very challenging circumstances that we're facing right now. I want to start by stating the working premise behind what I'm going to be talking about, and that concerns the goal of the Property Tax Aids and Credits Program. And that is to assure that all Minnesotans, regardless of where they live, have access to important public services at affordable tax prices. And if I want to put a coda on that, it would be, and to do all that in the most cost-efficient and effective way possible, given the budget circumstances we're facing right now. The reason I think that's important is because I think there always has been sort of a shifting perspective on what the goal of these sorts of things are. And most recently, we've seen a lot of arguments that suggest that the basis or the goal of these programs is to equalize tax bases across the state. And we would consider that a tactic rather than a public policy purpose. Equalization of tax bases might be a critical strategy to achieve that public policy purpose, but it shouldn't be considered an end in and of itself. So again, with the idea of looking at important services at affordable tax prices done the most cost-efficient way possible, I want to suggest three reform ideas or principles off the top and then talk a little bit more in detail about each of them and then offer some what we think are some possible reform ideas going forward. The first reform principle is that the primary focus should be on taxpayers and their property tax burdens, not the institutions. The second principle is that equalization aids, when they're provided, should focus on capital expenditures rather than current expenditures of local government. And finally, the aid system should also foster and support redesign and innovation in government service delivery rather than just support, in many situations, what might be an unsustainable status quo. Taking each one of these at a time, the first one, the idea of focusing on taxpayers and their burdens on institutions. I think you have in your handout a sheet that looks like this. It says changes in thinking in property tax reform will facilitate its enactment. This is actually from a property tax study that MTA did 20 years ago, which I guess suggests the timelessness of these debates, if nothing else. But essentially, it sort of lays out two conceptual approaches to thinking about this problem. The first of which is to focus on the important services dimension. And that is involves subsidization of local government services. And the subsidy is, of course, used for spending of all types, essential, non-essential, and everything in between, because, you know, general purpose aids are general purpose and fungible. It might result in some taxpayer relief or reduce some of the property tax increase pressures, but importantly, any relief that does materialize with that approach will accrue to all taxpayers and based on their ownership of property. So if you can consider the idea of regressiveness in a system like this, the fact that any relief that does occur just sort of goes across the entire spectrum of property tax owners or property taxpayers is something worth considering. The second path, of course, is to focus on the affordable services, the affordability piece of the equation. And that means focusing on effective tax rates, providing local governments full freedom to levy as they see fit based on their needs and expectations of their citizens, and then have the state step in with targeted relief to situations where ability to pay problems actually arise. We consider this to be the most direct and efficient way and the most progressive way, because the state obviously cares about that, approach to tackling this issue. You get the needed services piece, but you also get the affordability piece, and you target that affordability concern through the circuit breaker program. We applaud the way that graph has changed that was featured about 20 minutes ago, how direct relief, direct reform has taken on a larger percentage of the property tax aids and credits portfolio. We consider that to be a good development in the state. The implications for this, I think, can be found by referencing this changing in thinking sheet. Number one, we are now thinking that each piece of the state and local system can be debated in isolation, and that's an easy thing to do when you're talking about LGA. But from a system perspective, it's worth considering that any cuts or reforms that might materialize in the LGA program need to be considered in the context of the circuit breaker program and the direct relief program. And we would encourage that the circuit breaker program be given serious consideration potential enhancement with respect to any LGA reductions or cuts that take place. The other area where I think it has some implication is in number four. The homestead credit targets assistance towards low-valued homes. And those people may be needy, may not be needy. And I think a case can be made that we could fold the homestead credit into the circuit breaker program to enhance the ability to target the assistance of those who actually need it. The second reform idea concerns this idea of equalizing aids based on capital expenditures, not current expenditures. And you know, this is a big departure from how we think about LGA, but we offer three reasons for your consideration why this isn't a good thing to do. The first of which is on the back side of the sheet, that the handout you have. Last year, the state auditor provided its State of the Cities report, and the headline there was that real city spending has declined, I believe, 7% over the past 10 years. And we found that there was an important story within the story that was largely absent. And what this table attempts to do is sort of illustrate what's going on behind the scenes of that number. As you see in the title, this is the current expenditures of Minnesota cities between 1999 and 2008, taken from the state auditor's report. And you'll see that, not adjusting for inflation, current expenditures of city government went up about 68% over this 10-year period. But notably, if you look at the three columns there, those are inflation-adjusted numbers on three different measures of inflation. The first is CPI. The second is the implicit price deflator for state and local government. And the third is the municipal cost index, which is a specialty index targeting municipal governments. And you see in all three situations that the current expenditures of government increased substantially, robustly, I would even argue, in many circumstances, across most every aspect of current government operations, the exception being health care, and that's largely, we think, due to an assumption of a takeover of a hospital or something of that nature. But as you can see, robust double-digit increases in current expenditures. And that says to us that the ability to pay for current expenditures is well being satisfied by the situation that we have. Then the question, of course, is where did the 7% decline in city spending come from? Part of that's due to lower debt service. But the big thing was a 33% decrease in capital expenditures by cities. And that suggests to us a couple of things. First of all, that it is not unlikely that the current budgets of city governments are crowding out potentially needed capital expenditures by city governments. But also, when you look more holistically at some of the things that have been published in other areas, you see other capital needs looming on the horizon. The League of Minnesota Cities did a fantastic report several years ago documenting the capital requirements cities will be facing with respect to water-related issues, drinking water, wastewater, stormwater runoff-related issues. They documented about $9 billion worth of city spending coming down the pipe that needs to be addressed, and recognize that the amount of state support with the existing programs that we've designed to assist communities in that is lacking. The Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis came out with a great study last year looking at the problems of deferred maintenance on transportation infrastructure in counties and cities. I think these things suggest that there is a real need for capital reinvestment in a lot of these areas, and the need swamps the ability in many cases of local government cities and counties to pay for them through their property taxes. And these are the big ticket items which can break property tax capacity.
Mr. Haven, just a question. Where in the picture does some of the outside funding from the federal government, say for drinking water, facilities and wastewater facilities, how does that, come into this picture? And where do we take account of maybe what funds are being made available for those?
You would, Madam Chair, you would certainly have to do that. We haven't. We've just taken a cursory look so far at the number of programs, and there are several. I believe if I looking real quickly, I counted about 7 or 8 at the funded either at the state or federal level to support these sorts of things, and that would also have to be factored in type of in a aid assistance program that is designed to address these sorts of issues. But from what we can tell, especially given the federal dollars and the federal budget situation, those types of resources are drying up and unlikely to be readily available in future years. The second reason why we think a capital spending approach is a valuable way to think about this is that it allows you to extricate yourself from the biggest problem, Achilles heel, which has plagued the LGA program for as long as it's been in existence, and that is determining the neediness of cities. The current formula, appropriately, notes that tax capacity is only half of the issue. The other half is to determine how needy cities are, and what the formula does is try to fill the need capacity gap. We recognize, of course, that not all spending is need, and that introduces a whole host of complexities with regard to how do you measure and document need. We have long had many problems with the design and structure of the formula, which I won't get into now. But suffice to say, we don't do this well now. We don't think we've ever done this well. And more importantly, I think attempts to do this well will always run into the politics of aid distribution, because doing it well implicitly creates winners and losers. And the losers, of course, understandably, are not pleased with these new reform runs. So we think that a focus on capital spending allows you to extricate yourself from this, because the need is determined by the basis of the project rather than these abstract concepts of how, based on regression modeling and how accurately you measure those sorts of things. You can eliminate the need to sort of do that piece and focus your energies on the things which is understandable to all taxpayers, largely a tax-based equalization approach. Finally, another reason to address the capital expenditures is that they don't create spending tails. We have always had a long concern that the introduction of general purpose aids to communities distorts tax prices and may result in spending that local communities might not otherwise support with their property tax dollars. But it also has the significant potential to influence the cost structures of city governments going forward. And I'm not a big fan of using household analogies for purposes of comparing to government budgets, but I think this one has some applicability. Imagine if you are in very difficult and intense negotiations with respect to buying a house, and your own assets and income is the exclusive basis for your negotiations with that homeowner. Now imagine a situation where, in addition to your own assets and your own income, you have a benevolent grandfather that is willing to offer you $50,000 to purchase this house. We would suggest that implicitly the stridency of your negotiations will be materially affected by the introduction of that additional dollars. And we think that cost structures within city governments have been affected by these things. We've done some studies in areas of compensation and health care that suggest that we see evidence of that occurring. And by focusing on capital projects, you eliminate most of this tail-related problem. We know of several counties that have already taken this approach. They have not built what county program A that they have received into their general operating budgets, but have treated it as one-time money to address specific needs and issues that have come up over time. We think that's a very appropriate way to think about this. They have not created a burden in the future by building into their basic cost structures, and essentially an equalization aid program that takes that approach sort of institutionalizes that sort of thinking within city and county governments. The final piece we would offer for thinking about reform. Oh, let me see just how this equalization program would work. Again, it would be based on tax capacity. It'd be a function of just identifying how many cities you want eligible for aid and determining the level of equalization that you want to achieve with that type of program. Or conversely, you could work from the other direction and establish a budget for it and solve for the other two variables. The final reform idea is that aid should foster redesign and innovation rather than the status quo. You know, the evolution of cities continues to occur. Times change, and there might be situations there that are not simply sustainable under any form of state-local finance relationships. 15 years ago, the Brandel-Weber report introduced the idea of creating the village concept in Minnesota government, which is basically a situation where a community does competitive contracting for all its services, save for one person who is one or two people who are designed with controlling those types of contract type of situations. A few years ago, we had the Board of Cooperation and Innovation that attempted to support, through a couple of different grant programs, service consolidation and potential combinations of government. It was marginally funded to the tune of about $4.5 million, I think, over 5 years. But even that, according to studies that we've heard of, report a $7 return for every dollar invested on those sorts of programs. And so we feel that within the property tax aids and credits program, a carve-out of some sum, but significant sum, to support these types of initiatives around the state would be a worthwhile thing to do. It's not only an essential thing to do, but if there's one thing that we have going for us in these circumstances right now, is that we do have a demographic opportunity with respect to the aging of the public sector workforce. We've got a lot of folks approaching retirement, and monies like this might be used to support the transition of those sorts of folks and rationalize the government employment structure in the process. We've heard anecdotally from people who have talked about these sorts of reform efforts that, not surprisingly, one of the biggest issues is the labor force. These things sound great in practice, but it means getting rid of one purchasing manager or getting rid of one firefighter or something of that nature. And those are very, very real, very important issues that need to be addressed. But fortunately, we may have a way through the AIDS and Credits Program and this carve-out to address some of those concerns by facilitating the transition of that employment base. So with that, again, I appreciate the opportunity. I hope this gives you folks some grist for the mill in these very difficult times and in these very difficult discussions that you'll have.
Thank you, Mr. Haveman. Any comments or questions from the members? Yes, Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Mr. Haveman, I appreciate the comments on the redesign, and we worked and talked on some things last year. We were actually trying to resurrect kind of that innovation board, and you're right, that brought back, for every dollar invested, $7 back, and that bill made it all the way to the governor last year. And I do agree. I think, not only what Representative Dietrich and Representative Loeffler worked on those property tax benchmarks that we saw, but we also, there's a Council of Local Results and Innovation that's coming up with benchmarks for cities and counties, and I absolutely believe that's the right way to go, and how you work that into an overall property tax relief system is really good. On the one part, I don't quite know if I'm understanding you. Are you looking at, with some of the aids, that we should be really moving back from general purpose aids and really just allowing cities to just levy their wants and needs without kind of that? I mean, is that what I understand? I mean, your general philosophy would be just a really decreased general purpose aids and just, you know, to really increase transparency, just let cities and counties, or are you still would believe in some aid?
Mr.
Hayes? Or an equalization, that's the word.
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, we believe in putting the priority on the circuit breaker and the freedom and flexibility of local governments to levy accordingly, and assuring that the goal of reasonable or adequate services at reasonable tax prices is done through the circuit breaker program. We think a case can be made for aids, but we would much rather see it focused on capital expenditures, the capital budgets, essential infrastructure, emergency vehicles, depreciable assets, for the reasons I discussed earlier. That seems to be where the need is, and it seems to avoid a lot of the complexities which have occurred with general purpose aids that we feel has significantly harmed the efficiency of the program. And really, the thing that makes general purpose aids, the difference between a economically efficient, justified general purpose aid program and something that leans more towards a waste of taxpayer dollars, is the distribution formula, making sure that the money goes to the right places. And once upon a time, we believe that with careful thought and careful consideration, careful design, you could do something like that. And for lack of a better way to describe it, I think we've sort of given up on that idea because, as I stated, when we have attempted to do this in the past, and I would argue that there has been one time in the state's history where we spent considerable resources and effort, and that's with the infamous Ladd study in 1991, when the results of that formula came out, it was soundly rejected because the distribution, well, two things happened. First of all, it demonstrated the same amount of equalization could be done at about half the cost the current state was paying to the LGA formula. And the second thing that happened is that the distribution of that aid was so fundamentally different from the way the aid was currently being sent out there that it was just dismissed as being a nonsensical approach, so it was sort of a kill the messenger type of thing. And I think any effort to improve or retweak or reform these sorts of the general purpose aid program, where you create winners and losers, is going to run into the same thing. And by focusing on capital expenditures with the aid system, we think you can avoid that problem.
Representative Marquardt.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you, Madam Chair. And of course, no matter what we do, we create winners and losers. We're members of the Property Tax and Tax Committee, and you know, if we do a tax expenditure, we've got winners and losers. So it's not just local government aid where we end up talking about winners and losers. Every single thing you do in the tax code, you create winners and losers. But you know, you look at the most recently released Department of Revenue property tax burden report that came out just this month, and you look at effective tax rate, which is going across and looking at the percent of taxes you pay in proportion to your property tax wealth or property base wealth, and it stays fairly close. I mean, when you really look at it, Greater Minnesota's 0.91% and the Metro's 1.01, and that's really close. And you know, I've always thought you need these general purpose aids to equalize that portion of it. You go into communities and you equalize, and then you still have individuals that still are not equalized, and that's where the property tax refund program then equalizes your how much you're paying in property taxes based on your income wealth. And you need really both of those. And you know, for example, I was looking at a lot of the rural cities, and they're the ones that get hit when you talk about local government aid. And if we're talking the PTR, which goes to Metro, I'd be defending that just as strong because they work together somewhat. But most of the cities that you look at, the LGA is about equal to their levy. and I could go through them, but that's a lot of them. There's, in fact, some are 2-to-1 LGA to levy. And I calculated that if you took that LGA away, you would raise, on the average, roughly about a 50% tax capacity on all the properties in those cities. So like a business, commercial business, of $500,000 would pay another $4,600 in property taxes. $1 million business would pay another $9,600. And so where else do you equalize business taxes? Because the PTR doesn't hit that. The renter's credit doesn't hit that. And all of a sudden, you have, and also your effective tax rate in rural Minnesota would go up 0.50. You'd be looking at 1.41 versus 1.01. So I would argue that local government aid very effectively equalizes those property tax wealth and allows businesses to be on equal footing no matter where you're at in this state. And if you were to take that out of the system, it would create these huge disparities and businesses would be at a very much of a disadvantage in rural Minnesota than in the areas of the metro area. So I just don't think you can pull that out of there, and I know there will be a lot of talk about that. You know, home market values, I mean, you would see on a $150,000 home an income or a property tax increase of $750. And I think it's really good to look at this, and I know some have argued, well, actually in the metro area you have higher property tax burden and you have higher effective tax rates. And those are the areas that don't get LGA, so, you know, is that working? But if you look at the highest, it's Minneapolis at 1.14 effective tax rate. Mm-hmm. And they get LGA, so you could argue maybe they deserve, they should have more LGA if you use that type of an argument. And I don't know if anyone's going to say that. But, you know, I think the system is fairly good right now. And you look at that, and when you can be within a tenth of a percent on that statewide for the most part on average, I think it's kind of doing what it's supposed to be doing. Any comments on that?
And we have about 10 minutes left, so Mr. Haveman, if you have a comment on that?
Well, I guess we too found the VOS database and the effective property tax burden report very interesting, but of course, based on our preference to look at through the lens of, again, ability to pay the property tax, you do see extraordinary geographic diversity in the ability to pay the property tax around the state. On the median, the metro area homeowners pay about 40% more on a property tax burden than greater Minnesota counterparts. In 5 of the 10 greater Minnesota regions, more than half the homesteads pay less than $1,000 in net property taxes. That's everything, city, county, and schools. In 2 regions, more than a quarter of the homesteads paid less than $500 in property taxes, net total net property taxes. From taxes payable from 2007 to 2008, the median net property tax burden as a percentage of household income went down in 4 of the 10 Minnesota regions. Again, we think that what this suggests to us is that the LGA program might be exacerbating equity problems across the state rather than enhancing them because of the distribution formulas and how this is that's been occurring. You know, we know that a lot of these reductions in aid would likely result in increased property taxes. And for example, in Southwest Minnesota region, their year-on-year burden, according to the VOS database, went up 11.4%. That sounds like a lot, but it went up from $726 a year to $809 a year. That's $7 a month. So I guess the focus on equalizing tax capacity, as we suggest, is an important thing to do, but it's premised on the idea that local government's already using their existing tax capacity. And the VOS database to us tells us that in many cases, that's not the case, and that the LGA formula as it's currently designed is exacerbating disparities and inequity rather than enhancing it.
Okay, we're going to move on to Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. After your recent comments about the 40% of the property taxes paid by metro area is redistributed, I'm reluctant to ask my next question, but I'm going to anyhow because it's, I think, the right thing, the thing that we need to start having a conversation about, and that is your comments about market value homestead credit and possibly eliminating or phasing that out and moving that into the circuit breaker. Have you done any more research on that? Has the association done any more research on that that would show, would provide a timeline and a way to do that that would be, that the state could afford to get out of that business or that credit?
No, we haven't. We haven't modeled anything like that.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Okay, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was going to raise the point about the business relief that Representative Marquardt did, but I do want to, I think you've thrown out a really interesting idea about, you know, our unmet capital needs, but I would argue that probably the complexities of figuring out that would be as great as figuring out need and capacity within our existing aid formulas. And we've dealt with that in a whole bunch of different ways in the state budget. As you're probably aware of, our public finance agency steps up to small communities that don't have the tax capacity to deal with sewer system upgrades. We've dealt with it in the bonding bill. We've got Met Council in the metro area that takes a portion of responsibility for that. And it seems to me that the basic concept on those capital investments is that you do fund them long-term and you have long-term strategic plans, and it shouldn't be something that's dealt with in sort of the operating budget of tax relief. I think that our current tax relief system, as embodied in aids and credits, does really look at all the demands on local government, both in terms of operating programs, whether it's, you know, public safety and parks and in the cities, or basic human services and community corrections and the counties, and the capital needs that both of those support. It looks at the total. And I think we need to look at that, because I think the taxpayer, whether it's a small business or it's a homeowner or it's a renter, is going to be dealing with funding all of that, not just one component or another. And so I think you've identified an issue that we need to wrestle with. How do we deal with undermet capital needs, and how do we help support and incent our local governments to really take those seriously and give them the tools they need to address them? But I don't think it's going to be, it will look at the system as holistically as our current system does. And the complexities of capital, I don't know if you've had a chance to really wade into it, but I think we could end up with just as many issues as we've had in wrestling with AIDS.
Mr. Haveman.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, I think those points are very well taken. You know, obviously in any sort of capital equalization program, you would still want to, as you do right now with the current LGA design, look at, you know, revenue-raising capacity. Well, a revenue-raising capacity in a capital program would have to factor in eligibility for all those other sorts of programs that you've identified that might factor into local communities' ability to pay for those sorts of things. You know, we would, again, offer that this seems to be the area of greatest need for cities. It has the additional benefit as well, I would argue, of really addressing issues of potential regional consequence. You know, economists like to call the spillover effects. And that is probably one of the greater priorities that should be given to thinking about when, under what circumstances, you give local governments additional support. And these types of infrastructure programs would address a lot of those costs and benefits that go outside, beyond the city limits, affecting the broader community. And I would argue that those sorts of initiatives are most strongly deserving of state assistance, as opposed to those which are targeted more exclusively towards the needs of local citizens, of city residents themselves.
Okay, I'm gonna. I'm sorry, we've got a couple more that want to talk, and we've got a couple minutes, but did you have a follow-up, Representative Loeffler?
No, thank you.
Okay. And Representative Crawford?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Haveman. My question is very similar to Representative Loeffler's, and I think you pretty much answered it, but getting back to your second reason, you know, to go to capital expenditures rather than operating expenditures, and wouldn't that, I mean, I I guess I don't understand how we would get away from having winners and losers in that. Why one city would be able to do something that they considered important while some other city wouldn't. So,
Mr. Haveman.
Madam Chair, Representative Crawford, obviously this would be contingent on some sort of oversight group that would have to create parameters around which what would be considered eligible for essential infrastructure and provide that sort of oversight for something like this.
All right, and Representative Lucheski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here. I'm not speaking to you intentionally with my back to you. I'm just trying to use the mic. And I do think hearing the capital idea, you know, I hear that from a city that actually we don't do our levy for capital. We use debt instruments and public finance, and so I think large cities are able to do it very a really good deal for their taxpayers, and then of course they don't you know get things in the bonding bills and use like Representative Loeffler was talking about. So I kind of hear the capital thing as a proxy for need, and I know always measuring need are hard, but one other real simple way would just do per capita. I mean, all of these things would have inherent unfairnesses depending how you're measuring them. But I did just want to bring up, I have a bill that's not yet been introduced, but it's going in. I was just talking to one of the House researchers in the hall that I think will be interesting for people to think about, and I hope the chair will consider hearing it. And that is a bill that will abolish LGA, abolish county aid, abolish the biggest local property tax relief program in the state, fiscal disparities, abolish market value homestead credit, and you know, repeal all these equalization programs, so we can see what that means. And what it preserves is the circuit breaker, and in fact enhances it. So our speaker is just sort of talking about a bill I've got, and it keeps the renter's credit. So it keeps those two, also removing levy limits and maintenance of effort and local mandates. So we can just see, you know, should the state even bother to equalize anymore? If you know everything doesn't work, let's just pull out. And I think one thing we could learn in seeing what all the numbers show on that bill is, you know, really what will happen. Because people sort of opine this all the time, and I'm interested to know, and I hope, Madam Chair, you'll consider looking at that. I think that we continue to have a problem, though, in measuring capacity, not just need. Again, we don't count things like liquor stores and local option sales taxes. We don't count if people are doing tax increment financing, which is costing the taxpayers an arm and a leg across the state. So, you know, I really hope we'll kind of zero-based budget down on the whole property tax system, and I'm glad you had this speaker in today. Hopefully we can think broadly. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Haveman. You have opened up, I think, the windows a little bit, and this is, as I agree with you, we've got sort of the demographic issues that, you know, require us to do something fairly soon. So thank you, members.
Thank you.
Meeting adjourned.